Hello and welcome to episode 13 of the SRA podcast. This is your host, Alex Humva, back for another week of fun and excitement as always. Joining me this week is not Faye. I had to give Faye a break. So this week we have a returning guest from probably the second episode I started doing guests, I think. We have the return of Georgia Marxist, known to others as Brad sometimes. So welcome back to the show, Brad.
Thank you. That's right. My legal name is Georgia Marxist, but people call me Brad just as a nickname.
That sounds about right. So to kick this show off, we will do something we do every now and then and provide an update on the Socialist Rifle Association as we do. There has been some changes in the organization as of recently. So for those
good ones.
Very good ones. So for those who are unaware, the organization is going under some changes. So in the member Slack, we recently updated our members on this, that we have incorporated as a not-for-profit 501c4 in my home state of Kansas. The business laws were okay here and, you know, the fees weren't too much. So we are moving away from the previous model. This should allow us to do a lot more things as far as not getting taxed as heavily due to the current corporate structure. This has worked well for a while, but just due to the nature of these things, it's the way we've grown and with just how big the membership is, and of course trying to keep ourselves accountable to the membership, this change to the 501c4 corporation here in Kansas will be good for that, allowing us to move forward with just a lot more ease than maybe before. So we are in process of having that absorb the previous organization, and everything should be a smooth switch over. We haven't really run into any problems so far, so that should be finalized and completed definitely before the end of the month. This has allowed us also to adopt a new set of bylaws, so it's a little bit more in-depth now. Things of that nature.
And the LLC will be merged into the 501c4 here pretty soon, right?
Yes. Hopefully within the next week, we will have the ball rolling on that. We just have to finish up a few, you know, random business things to get that as smooth as possible. Right now, though, the organization is currently, as we record, doing something else, that we are once again doing hurricane relief. I am not in Georgia this time around. Unfortunately, the plane ticket was just a little bit too much to justify at this time, especially with the short warning that we had. Hurricane Michael really came out of nowhere. People did not see it coming like it was. It started out as just a tropical storm, and I believe almost made Category 5. I don't know if it quite made it to Category 5, but I remember it was just a hair away from being a Category 5 storm.
That number, regardless, the damage has been pretty devastating in a lot of the places it's hit.
Absolutely. I've seen just huge amounts of devastation across the regions affected, through Florida to Georgia to South Carolina to North Carolina. These regions already struggling from Hurricane Florence have now just absolutely, the devastation is truly awe-inspiring in the original sense of the word. But we are on the ground right now. A couple of our members are on the ground working with all sorts of organizations, Mutual Aid, Disaster Relief, those guys in the area, as well as Tallahassee DSA, as well as the PSL chapter in the area, as well as many other just great organizations that are in the area trying to help out, trying to get people the food and supplies they need. So our truck is probably just about to hit, actually. I believe it's about this time that they're supposed to be making it to Tallahassee. And they'll be working to distribute food to and other supplies. This time we focus not just on food and water, but also other sanitary supplies and basic needs as well, to make sure everyone has what they need.
Yeah, I feel really good about we learned a few things from the last hurricane relief effort, which I was a part of. I wasn't able to participate this time, but and we've really improved, and we've raised some more money. And I feel like even though it's our second one, we've honed it a little from the first one being so successful. And I'm actually really excited and really glad to see that this is a sort of thing that SRA is starting to do, because, you know, we've talked about ever since the inception of the organization, you know, what kind of activities are we going to do, you know, as a left organization, or, you know, outside of what scope of activities like Range Day we were already able to do. Because like the NRA, for example, does things like, you know, essentially bribing senators, doing politics, all the kind of underhanded political things. It's stuff that we have no interest in. They do a lot of stuff with, you know, gun manufacturers and the industry that, you know, it's not ever going to be on our plate or something we want to do. So I think, and Alex can attest to this, we struggled for a while with this sort of concept of what other sort of things that we can do. And it's developing into this sort of thing where we can be a force of mutual aid and put our membership and our resources towards mutual aid for the working class. And I like the direction that's heading a lot for us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I probably should have mentioned this earlier, but I'll go ahead and mention it now so it can be out there on the record. Since the SRA has converted to a 501c4, we do have officers now, and I was very fortunate to be nominated and elected president for the organization. So that's definitely something that's on my plate, that in the capacity that that role provides me, I want to make sure that this is something we continue to pursue. We continue to promote this idea of community defense, not just being about firearms. I've seen so many things coming in from people, new members coming into the Slack and saying they thought that we were all about guns, but when they found out we weren't, that they were perfectly willing to come and do membership stuff. And that's really encouraging to me. And that's something I really want to emphasize. And I think everyone on the committee is on the same page with that, that this is what we need to do, that community defense, firearm advocacy and rights are a very important part of it, obviously. But this is something that we have to keep focusing on, this idea of community defense being so much more than just immediate people who might be threatening your community. It's so much more with so many other factors that can threaten a community, like the environment, like just even day-to-day things like the inability for people to eat, this food poverty, where there's people going to sleep hungry. And that's something the community, if you're defending your community, you have to have things of this nature up and running. And it's something I'm really glad to see the SRA moving in this direction. And in the capacity I have now, I definitely want to make sure we keep moving in this direction of providing so many more support services, especially now that we are legally a social welfare organization. And that's something that we absolutely have to continue to push.
Yeah, I would echo all your thoughts. And maybe just one last thing I would add is the fact that there's such a need for us to do this work sort of really points to the sort of situation we're in our system here. We're not in a system that looks out for people. It's that people have to look out for themselves, that those who are taken care of in our society are those who have the means to do so. Like, you know, the mutual aid is needed because people aren't getting what they need from the system. And there's just going to be, I think, an increasing need for, you know, organizers and others to start filling in that role, especially as, you know, the economy may go sour and, you know, economic inequality is becoming worse and worse, not to mention climate change. And it's particularly noteworthy and interesting, I think, the example that we're doing now is hurricanes. Because you can, there's a definite thing you can compare it to for contrast. A place which gets hit by a lot of hurricanes, bad ones frequently, is Cuba. But Cuba is not ravaged nearly as badly by its hurricanes like its neighbor Puerto Rico, because they have really the world's best hurricane response system, where every citizen is knows where they're taken care of. You know where you're going. You know where your family and your kids and your grandkids and your cousins will be going. It doesn't matter if you don't own a car, if you live in the, you know, lowliest hut way out in the middle of nowhere, someone will come and get you and evacuate you and you'll be provided for. And it's just such a stark comparison to like what happens when a hurricane hits under the system we're in, which, you know, it really, comparing the two systems shows how broken ours is and the need to replace it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I do believe that, I mean, there's so much we can do And just looking at the numbers of what's out there, if you look at established organizations like calling back to like the NRA, I mean, LaPierre, when he was president of the NRA, was drawing a $3.3 million salary or something like that. In the millions. Absolutely absurd. And it's so much money. And you think for what it would take to properly compensate somebody who's running the an organization as large as the NRA, because of course it does take a lot of effort to do that, but it's certainly not millions of dollars in compensation. And so even somebody who is making a very generous salary, even $300,000, that's another $3 million that you could take to do things like this. We raised $3,500 this time around before we ended up shutting the GoFundMe down, just because we didn't want to take more money, because we didn't want that to go to waste, that, you know, if we're kind of having the trouble spending that money. It's so much.
Shout out to the anonymous big donor.
Oh, yes. The anonymous big donor who donated $1,312. That was a fascinating donation, we'll go ahead and say. So big, big shout out to whoever dropped that bombshell on us. And then many others who gave very large, very generous contributions to it. So you think if we raise $3,500, how much could we do with $3 million? How much food is that going to buy? How much could that help rebuild a community? How much could that go to help clear out these areas and provide a better situation? I mean, if we're working at economies of scale here, it could do a huge amount of good. And instead, we have organizations like this that are collecting members' dues and donations and such, and not doing things like this. It's we'll go ahead and say it doesn't take $3 million to go stand in Congress and give a nice speech.
Definitely. And the anonymous donor, I'm sure that most, if not all, of our listeners would already understand the significance of the number 1312, but maybe explain it maybe to people who are new or might not have heard this before, if that was the particular donation amount.
Yes. So 1312 is the numerical designation on the alphabet. So the place. So 1 is A, 3 is C, 1 is A, 2 is B. So ACAB, which is best translated as "All Cops Are Bastards." So it's a kind of, I guess, one of those slogans that many on the left have, denoting that, you know, under the current system of capitalism, the police and law enforcement are ultimately beholden to the forces of capital. So
the cops are definitely not your friends. So
certainly not under the system of capitalism that we exist in. And but before I go on a long rambling tangent about that, I'd like to again thank everyone who donated to the cause. Thank everyone who's in the organization, who's supporting these efforts, who gives donations to these relief efforts. And I hope that this is something we continue to do whenever there's a disaster, and whenever we have the ability to go help, that we go and help, because that's something we have to be doing, and that's something we have to be spending our money on. So we'll take this opportunity to transition into the first kind of general topic of the night, that we have the tech sector. So technology sector, the Silicon Valley, this kind of culture around it. We'll begin with the show's favorite recurring character, Elon Musk, who just can't keep himself out of the news.
Yeah, he's not been having the best time lately, and there's been some, schadenfreude from that, if that's how you pronounce that word. I think I've only ever seen it typed.
Yeah, I think it's schadenfreude or schadenfreude. I actually don't know. My German wrestlings aren't.
We can keep trying, but we're just going to further make fools of ourselves.
Most likely.
But yeah. No, he's had some rocky times lately. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, like we discussed last time, the SEC, they told him that you can't manipulate markets like he did. And he backed down on that, and he resigned as head of the board. And, you know, he stepped down. He's still CEO though. So he's still, you know, in a very good position. But Musk, apparently nobody has told him that, you know, sleep is a good thing, that you should get your 8 hours of sleep a night, and like definitely a man in his position. He's in the position that he can get his 8 hours of sleep a night, and it's just really healthy for your brain and really healthy for how you think. But nobody's told him that the ever infamous elongated muskrat has sent out some more tweets. Nobody's taken his Twitter account away from them. But you know, that's a long, proud American tradition now of various famous figures with various incendiary Twitter remarks. I'm looking at it right now that Musk tweeted out Thursday of last week, it looks like. He tweeted out this: the short seller enrichment condition is doing incredible work, and the name change is so on point. So this is, of course, a dig at the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission, that, you know, stripped him of his position off the board and was really pretty nice to him in their judgment.
Yeah, and I believe he didn't just, and I might be wrong about this, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe he not only just like, just, it was more than he just stepped down as CEO. Wasn't it like ruled that, or not as CEO, but as a director of the board, wasn't it basically ruled that he couldn't be and he couldn't serve in that capacity in the future, or am I getting something wrong here?
So he basically did the equivalent of a plea bargain with the SEC, that if the SEC had pursued civil action against him, they could have stripped him of everything. They could have taken him down as CEO. They could have taken him down as head of the board. They could have done a whole lot of things because it was so blatant how he was manipulating the markets. So he took the equivalent of a plea bargain and made a deal with the SEC that he agreed to step down from the board and cannot serve in that capacity for 3 years, amongst a few other things.
Gotcha.
So he is legally bound by that. Again, they could have done a whole lot worse than what he ended up agreeing to with them. It's just, you know, they prefer to get a consensual agreement rather than take this to court and force something. So, apparently this tweet, it's not, didn't break any rules. It says here, Thomas Gorman of the law firm Dorsey and Whitney said the tweet was, quote, ill-advised.
I like a cool-headed lawyer just putting it that way.
So it's probably not the best idea to taunt the organization that, you know, regulates a very significant portion of your business, but what can we say? Representatives from the SEC and Tesla chose not to respond to this, so I guess this is just another chapter in the ever-eventful Elon Musk saga.
But did I see today where they're selling tequila, or is that a joke, or what? Did you see this?
I have not seen it today. I figured that would have popped up on my feed, but I did not see tequila. I know it probably wouldn't be the craziest thing they've ever done. The Boring Company sells flamethrowers now, so yeah, I guess. It would not surprise me if they were selling tequila. I don't know if that's a joke or not.
I just Googled it, and the headlines just glancing at them are about him developing a, or them filing for a trademark for a tequila brand or something.
Huh. Well, you know, if that's what Musk wants to do, you know, we
Tesla Kila is the trademark they applied for.
Awesome. So I guess you get a bottle of Tesla now, or a bottle of tequila now with your Tesla.
I don't know. Maybe the car will run on it.
That would be interesting. Booze filled.
Probably not the most efficient way to fuel a vehicle.
I don't know. Grain alcohol is actually, it's a really efficient chemical reaction when you burn.
No, that is true, I guess. Anyways, we're taking a tangent.
We are taking a tangent. Let us continue on this path through Silicon Valley. Fascinating story that also came up was a Siri shortcut. So Apple's been revamping their general purpose AI Siri to be more useful. They've really fallen behind in the AI race, as it were, that Amazon and Google's versions of AI have really outpaced them. So they've done some tweaks to Siri. Now you can program things when you tell Siri to something, you can program specific phrases in so that it knows what to do, rather than, you know, what Google's done where they're trying to algorithmically learn what needs to be done. So there's an app that will now allow you to say something to the extent of, let's see here. So if you say, hey, Siri, I'm getting pulled over, this app will start recording video. It'll start recording your audio. It'll start recording your location, things of that nature, so that if you have a not good interaction with during a traffic stop, then your phone is there to provide the evidence that might be necessary afterwards.
That wouldn't be the worst thing if it wasn't, you know, being handed to you by a giant corporation, or that wasn't who was providing it. I mean, that could be useful.
Absolutely. It is interesting to me that, you know, this is kind of that intersection of technology and society that, like discussed on the last podcast when we were talking about the Apple Watch and calling 911 if you fall down the stairs. It's kind of one of those interesting things that this is something that's very useful, that having just an SOS feature on your phone. I know Samsung Galaxies have had an SOS feature that you can program where if you hit the power button, I think, 3 times, or the home button 3 times, back when they still had a home button, they would start recording. It would send out a message to, 5 pre-programmed contacts saying, hey, I just sent out an SOS beacon or whatever. Here's my location. And it would start recording and stuff. It's an interesting thing that this is a very useful thing, but it shows evidence in our society that this is such a common occurrence that people feel the need for this. And there's a market need for something like this. It's so common, and it's really telling that I don't think this is at all something that's, you know, security theater or something, or somewhere people are just super paranoid, because this is really a reality people live with every day, that just traffic stops sometimes don't go very well. And of course, it's one of those situations that people can say, well, you know, there's tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of traffic stops a day, and so many of them are just plain as day, ordinary things. And it's like, well, yeah, the percentages might be low. But the cost of something going wrong, it's a very high cost if something does go wrong.
You would have to have your head pretty far in the sand. You would have to have some pretty purposeful, willful ignorance to claim that there's nothing wrong with the way policing is done in the United States, that being pulled over can't and doesn't often lead to major problems. I mean, it's trying to justify the system is at odds with reality. It's to say that it's not needed would be a hard position to take.
Absolutely. So I will have this in the show notes, as always, for people who want to check this out for their own personal use. But that does kind of segue as well into this article on the Wall Street Journal, which... I won't discuss too much the particulars of the Wall Street Journal, but this is just a topic I want to touch upon because it intersects with this idea of technology and society and what is technology's role in helping us. And so this article the Wall Street Journal published is entitled "Facebook's Zuckerberg Tells Employees to Respect Diverse Views of Colleagues." And I find it very, very interesting because this comes out at a time that a lot of things are happening. That, you know, Silicon Valley is this strange melting pot of libertarian idealism as well as progressive idealism. And it's this really strange corporate culture that has developed in Silicon Valley of these folks who have very strong individualistic mindsets, but also have a very strong, almost crusader-like mentality that they have a particular gift and that they can go save society. And it's one of those things that it's not a bad thing to say, I have skills and abilities and I can go help people. That's a very good thing. Wanting to help others, of course, that's a very good thing. That's the core foundation of mutual aid and things like that. But you get into this weird mentality, and I feel this has really come up in places like Facebook and Google and Microsoft and other companies, Amazon to a lesser extent, just because of how their corporate culture is run, that it's this really strange holier-than-thou, we'll go ahead and say, attitude, that, oh, we know better than other people. We know better than these people who are so stupid to go vote for somebody like Trump. And we know better, and we're going to save people from themselves. And this is really evidence that with somebody like Mark Zuckerberg, an ardent capitalist, I mean, obviously he's what we could describe as an entrepreneur. He's very much a venture capitalist at this point. He has a lot of investments in other things. He's very steeped in the system of capitalism. And here he is talking, giving a speech to his employees about let's embrace these progressive liberal ideals. And let's make sure we respect the diverse viewpoints of colleagues. And let's make sure we respect everyone's viewpoints, using this very progressive language. While at the same time, Facebook is banning leftist groups left and right. I mean, Facebook and Twitter both are getting a lot of publicity now, that especially in leftist circles. I haven't really seen it in the mainstream news media as much because they aren't interested in things like this, apparently. But a huge amount of leftist Twitter accounts and Facebook pages have suffered adverse reactions, even as the Facebook CEO is up here saying, well, we got to respect everyone's viewpoints. And what inevitably happens, I feel, especially in a situation like Silicon Valley, where you have this place steeped in libertarian ideology, I feel like this is what always happens, where the left ends up being silenced during this, and then the right is given a platform because, well, we have to respect everyone's viewpoints.
Yeah, and another example of something recently that's brought that to people's attention is Jeff Bezos getting Equality Award. I don't know if you saw that.
I have not.
Yeah, I was seeing some posts on Twitter about that, but yeah, it's really the entire Silicon Valley and like high capitalist tech culture. It's a really perverse manifestation of the capitalism, modern capitalism. And, you know, for all this culture of the bourgeoisie, you're highly concentrated there. They're capitalists. They've got the reins of society and wealth. And they think that they can solve these problems. And because, I mean, they live in a bubble, both socially and mentally. And it's just, you know, they're extremely powerful because of their relation to capital. But in actuality, it's such a farce. And these companies wreak so much havoc and destruction, not to mention what the, you know, highest players in capitalism are doing to the environment. And, you know, the recent UN report that has everyone rightfully worried. But, you know, look at the way Amazon treats its employees. And then, you know, look at what Facebook has done, like made this market where you're the commodity, basically. Like the user is what's being sold, is your data. And they do these things hand in hand with the government. I mean, they couldn't exist without their relationship to the capitalist state. If they didn't have this capitalist state, you know, holding their hand as a partner, it wouldn't be able to be this way. And they definitely do. You know, scratch the state's back in return as well. You know, it's well known that like Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook higher ups have had very cushy relationships and, you know, made deals with elements of the government, you know, like backed by the Department of Defense, or like trying to have a particular narrative out there about Syria. If you look at or like things like Syria or North Korea or China or Russia, or how all the media spins it, and they work hand in hand with each other because they have to. So the notion that they're actually going to save the world is completely backward.
Absolutely. And it only further serves to entrench the capitalist state when, you know, progressive activists go and celebrate, and not even just celebrate, but actively work with individuals and companies like this, of saying, well, you know, we got to work within the system and we got to support these companies that are doing good. And, you know, it's okay to recognize that a company could be doing good, but you also have to recognize at the same time that any benevolence from a company, you can find evidence of corporate benevolence, but at the same day time, it is no different than a benevolent king. That just because you might have a good king who, you know, treats his subjects well, does not justify the system of a monarchy. In the same respect, these social crusaders in Silicon Valley, one, some of them might have their hearts in the right place, but many of them do come from this situation of, holier than thou, we know better than you, so let's reshape the world in our image so that things can be better. Proper change cannot come from these corporations. Proper change can only come from the bottom from the bottom up, from the working class, the striving to make these situations better.
Absolutely. I mean, and these corporations are 100% doing more harm than good. I mean, the complete reorganization of the economy and society that we need urgently, they're a core component of the problem, in fact.
Absolutely. Well, we'll go ahead and kind of transition from Silicon Valley corporate stuff to a topic at the heart of the SRA, oftentimes, that in our community of corporations and guns, the interface between firearms and corporate world, and part of this social activism as well of what companies feel like they need to be doing to, you know, appease the populist social sentiment out in America. So most recently, there's been some kerfuffles with banks. We've talked about this previously on the show, that banks have been turning down lines of credit to firearm manufacturers or associations associated with firearms. But in a kind of a doubling down, as the article put it, on their commitments, the Wells Fargo Corporation has issued a new line of credit to the gun manufacturer Storm & Ruger. This recent wave of financial institutions not wanting to back the gun industry, they seem to be bucking the trend. For instance, Bank of America, Citigroup, JP Morgan Chase, they've all committed to reducing their ties and liabilities connected with the gun industry. I guess Wells Fargo is also providing services for the National Rifle Association, the NRA. So I find this interesting because this is another case where, you know, social activists or, you know, progressive activists in general who are not favorable to the current firearm situation in America will try to use the capitalist system to affect their change. And of course, we saw last episode about how the shareholders at American Outdoor Brands were able to clamp down on Smith & Wesson and further, or at least commission a study on gun safety and see what Smith & Wesson can do to contribute to gun safety, which of course isn't bad in theory, but how this is actually going to play out, who can say?
Yeah, and I mean, their motivations is to trying to cut, you know, what they would think of being motivated to take a gun safety research on or to actually, you know, put resources towards making guns safer is questionable, because they're entirely driven with Smith & Wesson, like any corporation in America, by profit. I mean, they have to seek profit. So how they would even go about this or with from what angle is unclear.
Absolutely. And it's one of those things that very rarely do these activists who are supporting these measures or going through the capitalist system to get this done, very rarely are they addressing the severe issue we have with police violence. That's a significant factor in firearms violence in America, is how firearms are used by law enforcement. And very rarely are these things being done to say, I mean, it's an interesting situation to me that these banks are quibbling about providing support for these institutions and these corporations that are manufacturing guns, supporting firearms rights. But then you will never see Bank of America say, well, we aren't going to provide a bank account for a police union anymore. We're going to revoke our bank accounts with police unions because there's such a trouble with police violence.
It's a good point.
Where you never see that, or a particular department like Ferguson that's come out, that the Department of Justice at the federal level has said there's systematic biases and just severe discrimination going on in the various departments that the Department of Justice at the federal level has investigated. And you will never see these banks take action against those departments because the public outcry from people who, you know, simultaneously say the government can't tread on them, don't tread on me, but then will always, always support their local law enforcement agency and can never be critical of them unless it affects them, of course. If they have a bad experience, then they will be the first to go on and say about how the jackbooted thugs are coming. But if it's affecting somebody else, they have a much harder time sympathizing with that and advocating on those folks' behalf, especially when those folks are not of their people group. It's fascinating to me to see how this corporate activism is taking place, but at the same time not addressing these serious issues. And just tying this again into climate change, because that's going to be pretty much the central theme of this episode, are you going to see Bank of America not extend a loan to British Petroleum because they're literally helping the speed up the drastic changes in our environment? We're seeing that they're polluting the oceans with oil spills because of safety issues that were brought up to them before their oil rigs had disastrous disastrous breakdowns. We don't see that, but this is an easy issue because this is a hot button issue that you can appeal to people's, you can use the thing about the children argument, and it's an immediate emotional appeal, even though the same argument can be used about climate change. Think about our children and think about the world they're going to have to grow up in when the world is drastically different because of the Anthropocene. And but because it's not an immediate issue, because there's not dead bodies in front of us, because it's in the future, people don't care.
Yeah, and you know, it's going to be an interesting back and forth, I think, in the coming years in America with gun rights. As it stands now, it's favorable for gun ownership and the gun industry in America. It's a shame it's a capitalist one, and there's so many problems with enforcement and gun control and all sorts of things. But, you know, it's currently a rather favorable climate. But as the actual climate, you know, continues inching towards an extinction level event, and with the decline of the U.S. empire and with the shadow of fascism looming over all of us, look at the recent Brazil elections that have recently gone to a runoff as a very frightening far-right client almost outright won. He got so much of the vote there's also a rising movement worldwide and here in the imperial court in the United States too. People are discontented, and people know that a big change needs to take place. So we may see where the pendulum swings the other way in this country with a rollback of the ease to get firearms. You know, that we may see the sort of gun control as its mass, which is I would usually refer to as more of an anti-gun movement, start to move forward with the government seeing it more favorably. But it's not as cut and dry here. It's there's hundreds of millions of guns in circulation, and I don't think it's going to be as easy to just put down the gun industry as if they're not as if they don't have a lot of capital and influence in this country. And it's hard to say what's going to come, but you know, at SRA we do what we can is we approach the situation from the from a class perspective, and you know what the working class needs in America. And it's going to be interesting to watch, and we'll have to adapt, but it's hard to say how that's going to go in the coming years here.
Absolutely. And those Brazil elections, it is a truly frightening situation.
Terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. Did you see the photo of the girl that got the swastika carved in her neck?
Absolutely. I did see that. And for listeners who did not, there was a woman who had a swastika carved into her skin, into her flesh, on her neck for speaking out against this fascist candidate that they are running for president.
Wearing a t-shirt, mildly critical of him.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's terrifying. And I was reading a report of there was another woman who spoke out against the candidate and was writing, I think, like, not him or never him on her cell walls. And then the Brazilian police stripped her naked and beat her until she said, oh my God. Yes, him.
Oh my God.
It's an absolutely terrifying situation of what's going on. Truly terrifying.
And you know, Lula is still behind and is still incarcerated on trumped up charges.
Absolutely. Yes. It's the amount of repression that we are seeing in Brazil, and for their far right candidate to be speaking so openly and so brazenly about return to military rule, return to a military junta or a fascist state of rule. That's just, it is a terrifying situation to be in. And I have greatest sympathy for our comrades in Brazil who are trying to keep this from happening.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it might serve as a useful lesson or warning to us in the United States that, just trying to participate in the system and just relying on the bourgeois elections and the things that are already in place and not being prepared for more dire circumstances here. I mean, to put it lightly, we should look to what's happened in Brazil to an example where that's just, outright turned against any. It's just devolved into a nightmare situation, and you have to be prepared for almost any means necessary or to work under any kind of circumstances.
Absolutely. Tying that into talking about Trump, that he most recently, he was talking to a rally. He's been tweeting stuff out. He's been saying, this stuff against Kavanaugh, how Kavanaugh's been so unfairly treated and how this is a really historic moment that he got nomination and that the Senate approved him by 50 votes, by the way, that it was extremely close. And, Senator Manchin, I believe, the senator from West Virginia, a Democrat, crossed the aisle to vote him in. If his vote hadn't been there, Kavanaugh would have been turned down. So just further going to show, yeah, they can say all day long that, oh, Manchin isn't a good Democrat and he's really just a Republican. It's like, well, at the same time, how many times just now that's come out that Democrats have made a deal with the Republicans, they're going to nominate and pass through a dozen more judges at the lower levels in the circuit courts and the appeal courts of just, there is a lot of partnership when it comes to this level. And they can, now that the big story of Kavanaugh is over, the Democrats will go right back to cutting deals with the Republicans so that they can retain any sort of influence that they can stick to. And it's all, unfortunately, it is, these things are very bipartisan in nature, and the Democrats will just exploit it for their own electoral gain. But in the meantime, Trump's been stirring up fears and anxieties and talking about these paid protesters and how the Democrats are out of control and that they don't deserve to govern, that they can't govern because they're so out of control. And he, of course, is doing this to stir up support for the Republicans in these coming midterms. And it's a very interesting and frightening change in the political rhetoric that, of course, Trump's been saying this since day one. But for him to be in the position that he is now and saying these things out in the open and nobody really seeming to care that much that a sitting president is actively calling the opposition party illegitimate and not deserving to govern and violent and all these things to delegitimize them and calling the elections into question as well, like he did during the presidential election, that he said that if he didn't win, he would call the election into question. And now he's saying the exact same thing, that if Republicans don't win this midterms, he's going to call the elections into question. And just this normalization, this is the thing, that this is a normalization, that we hear this and then we don't think about it when it happens again. And it's a truly frightening thing watching a society be normalized to this sort of rhetoric.
Yeah, absolutely. And, as far as the situation with the Democrats, this is what we've got here in America, is this sort of fake democracy. Like, the bourgeois democracy has just evolved to the point where it is. And it's the result of having two right-wing parties. I mean, we're a two-party system with essentially two right-wing parties. One of them's a far-right party and one of them's center-right. But, I mean, they're both ostensibly right-wing in their relation to capital and imperialism. And they both uphold those lines. And so, I mean, it's a constant lurch rightward when you have two right-wing systems. You're either going, or two right-wing parties. You're either going far-right, full steam ahead, or you're going much slower, depending on, the Democrats at the time. But this is what it's this is the end result of that.
Absolutely. And I don't have too many more thoughts about it other than this. It's draining. It's draining watching this, and it's draining what people not seeing how disastrous this could be and not actively advocating. And I mean, I'm a very electoral guy. A lot of folks don't engage in electoral politics, and I completely understand why. And I completely understand as that in the system America is in, it's very difficult to do that.
I do feel like even if you're completely despondent about America's two-party system, I personally am of the conviction that you should be prepared and considered to use any tool at your disposal, electoral system, legal or otherwise. You know, just you shouldn't rule anything out as far as making advancements.
Absolutely. And in this context, I mean, America has a very strong tradition of leftist parties that engage in the electoral system that we often forget that there was once a time in America in the early 1900s when we had a very strong socialist movement that people were getting elected to office. Even in this two-party system, there is still a way forward that there were socialist candidates pushed into the House. There were used to be socialist candidates in Congress. There was a lot of activity in state legislatures of socialist candidates being elected to state legislatures. Very strong electoral politics back then. Of course, times have changed, and that was defeated in many different ways, from both infighting within the party to government crackdowns and government oppression of the parties, especially during World War I and later after World War II, that it became almost impossible to run a genuine leftist electoral party. But times have changed. We do live in a different era now. We live in an era where leftism is seeing a resurgence almost unlike anything it's seen in its history, that this is really starting to rival the leftist surge we saw in the early 1900s as organized labor took hold. And it is something I feel, if you have to work within the system you're in, and, you know, building power bases of saying we're going to have our own infrastructure, we're going to provide things like mutual aid when the government doesn't provide it, we're going to do these things when the capitalist system does not provide it, that's all very good. And at the same time, you got to use all things at your disposal. As long as that system exists, you have to be able to work and attempt to change the system as it does exist. And when the day comes, if the day comes that system no longer exists, then great, we can put in a new one. But until that time, we still have to get through day to day. And certainly memeing on Twitter about your dual power is maybe not the best way to go about, you know, us actually establishing these things.
Yeah, and not to make the segment run long, but there's still a lot of, you know, activity and people willing to use the electoral landscape here in America towards socialist ends. I mean, there's, you know, all kinds of news over the past few months or year or so about DSA candidates, and although many of them are quite flawed, and you can point to a lot of criticisms as with both individual candidates and maybe the strategy at large within DSA, it's notably different than, you know, go back 5 years, then you didn't really see anything like that. Or, you know, like hanging out with other comrades and at events for Party of Socialism and Liberation, they do run candidates, both for president and recently for governor of California, not expecting to win, knowing that they're not going to win, but just more of an outreach and sort of, you know, getting the message out kind of thing. And people often talk about those campaigns as, and that they, you know, generate not winning numbers or anything close to it, but, you know, still tens of thousands of votes. And it's sometimes commented on, you know, there's 10,000, tens of thousands of people that are, you know, willing to like show up and vote and then vote for the candidate with that supports, you know, Cuba and the DPRK and China and, you know, the genuinely like left-wing candidate. There's like tens of thousands of people that are willing to show up and do that. Shows that it's an arena you can't really ignore.
Absolutely. And I mean, yeah, it is a lot of effort to go and vote, so being able to show numbers. And certainly I'd really love to see leftist parties get involved at the state level, that these are things where, you know, especially here in places like Kansas, where state house, you're representing 13,000-15,000 people. That's the sort of numbers that you can go door to door and you can talk to a lot of people in your district and get a very good idea of what's going on, versus even stuff like Congress or governor, where you have hundreds of thousands, millions of people you're representing. It's very different when you get to the local level. And I do think people, if you can actually engage with people, I think there's a better chance than a lot of folks would give credit for of a genuinely leftist candidate being able to win at a local level in a smaller situation like a state house or state legislature.
Yeah, we're just going to have to keep an eye out and see how it goes, and you know, be vigilant against, you know, opportunism and sort of that the sort of dangers that come along with that territory. But it'll be interesting to watch.
Definitely. Well, as we transition to our final segment of the night, I'd like to put my now standard message out to the viewers that as climate change affects us all and the Anthropocene is just ever so slowly creeping along towards quite potentially disastrous ends, depending on exactly what we do now and how we react to it in the future. I think we might already be a lost cause, but in the event that it is not and the world can be salvaged, you know, I would like to be around to continue to discuss the ever-evolving world in this format on the podcast or whatever magical means we have in the future. Perhaps something will come along that replaces podcasts. Perhaps I will beam my thoughts directly into other people's minds in the future. Who knows? But in some way or another, I wish to be around discussing it. So as part of that, I do have a Patreon at patreon.com/socialistrapodcast, where you can donate starting at $5 a month to get access to premium content. I am planning another premium episode that will be actually Patreon only. The first one we, of course, released to the public so that folks could see what it's all about. I am planning to get another one out here pretty soon for a mystery topic that is to be revealed soon as well. So if you enjoy the podcast, you want to support it, and you want to get a few extra things from it, then feel free to go to that Patreon page and chip in as you feel viable and as you are able to. So yes, our final topic of the night is climate change and hurricanes and the disastrous things that are going on around the world. There are a plethora of articles that have come out lately that basically say we are really not in a good position. The EPA under the Trump administration has come out and said, climate change is a thing and we can't do anything about it. So we might as well just go ahead and burn all the oil because we can't do anything about it anyway. So why stop now? We have things like these hurricanes. You have stuff like Hurricane Michael, a historic storm that has devastated the communities. This is only going to get more and more common as people don't realize sometimes the scale of these things. And as in what we could now call the mathematics podcast, since both me and Brad have a background in mathematics, the quantities of scale, the powers that come with this, that people have to realize that even a 1 degree Celsius change in ocean temperature, when you realize that the ocean has just such a unimaginable amount of water and for so much to be warming, the amount of energy being stored in water is a truly awe-inspiring amount to behold. And it's what fuels these hurricanes, that you have energy quantities that make nuclear bombs look like firecrackers in comparison, that fuel these very powerful storms and fuel these very disastrous changes we are seeing to the environment in the form of climate extremification, that cold places are going to get colder, warm places are going to get warmer, dry places are going to get drier, wet places are going to get wetter, and everything else that things could, certain environments will see a flip, that maybe a dry location will become wet and a wet location will become dry. Just very radical changes to our world going on. And there's a huge amount of consensus. There's a huge amount of stories out there right now because scientists are increasingly saying, look, this is a serious issue and this is not going to end well for any of us if we don't address it now.
Yeah, the UN report was really, really written with a lot of urgency. I think it was just like they poured through like just thousands of peer-reviewed articles And I mean, like you were saying with the temperatures, they were saying like a 1.5 degree rise would be just catastrophic, pretty much as far as the effect it would have. And we're definitely headed towards that. But if we just completely put all our energy into it, maybe we could avoid 1.5, but more than likely we're looking at 2. And the time scales was so short. And there is a part in there that they basically said in the UN report, if you caught this, like we would have to just, we could do it. Like they gave us some hope. Like we have the technologies, we have the means, but it would take like a drastic reorganization of the way we hold our economy and like the way we run things. Like it would require just like complete rethinking of everything we're doing. It's almost as if the UN report was hinting at the need for a revolution, as many people have commented on. And that is all true, is that we do have what it takes, and there is the technology out there, and we could, you know, shoot for just catastrophic destruction, or just what we've already seen is going to get much worse. Absolutely. But we could shoot for that versus an extinction level event or minimizing it. But it would require a complete upside down reorganization of not just the economy, but all of society to do something like this. And that's the choices we're faced with right now. Although those are the two paths we can go down, is either extinction or some kind of socialist, some sort of social revolution. I think we would both advocate for a Marxist one, but I mean, those are the only two roads at this point.
So I guess something that has come up in discussions of both with folks who maybe are completely left-leaning or even leftists that I've talked to about this, because this is a very, very serious topic to discuss and a very serious thing to get a picture of what should we do. And a lot of folks have pointed out that, okay, if we here in the first, quote-unquote, first world have the ability to do this, what then becomes the responsibility of other countries? That a very popular example, in some ways, yes, in some ways, no, it's not appropriate, that there's a lot of variables you have to take into consideration. But, of course, something that does come up in these circles is the amount of pollution that has been caused by places like China and India. Of course, India does not exist under a leftist government, but China does at very least hold itself out to be a very leftist socialist country, and in many ways it is. How do we treat these situations of... Clearly, China has realized this as well, and I think this is maybe an argument that people don't make with the best of knowledge of what's going on, that China has very much dedicated itself to renewable energy because it sees the dire consequences of it. Many of its cities still are plagued by pollution, and it understands that a change is necessary and change must happen. But for other countries that are developing, for other countries that, like India, that are still in many ways developing and getting to what we would call a first world, quote unquote, situation, how do we work with those countries that the Paris Accords kind of added this in, a recognition that some countries are going to take longer to switch over? But how do we recognize for countries that are poor, that aren't as well developed, that need something like fossil fuels that have been historically used because they are so cheap and easy to use and have such a large energy content stored in them? How do we go about, if we are looking at this from a worldwide perspective, and we really have to in order to enact significant change, how do we look at that for countries that don't have the resources necessarily to get solar power or hydropower or wind power, these renewable resources? Or even then, a topic that people don't look at as much maybe is for things like wind power. Windmills require extensive amounts of rare earth minerals that the refining process of these create very toxic, very hazardous byproducts. And so even as the Western world develops these renewable energy sources, the severe consequences, these toxic dumps that come from the production of these renewable energy resources are being left in the developing world, where it's having very serious consequences on everything from childbirth to cancer rates to things of that nature. So I guess rephrasing the question, how do we look at this from a worldwide perspective, and how do we take into account other countries' struggles that they're going to have, even as we look at our own, of switching this paradigm over.
Yeah, definitely. It's a really important point. I think that the starting point here with the international discussion is to point out that the current ruling class, the current capitalist ruling class of the world and the United States, absolutely would and does plan to let much of the rest of the world burn and to try to save itself as much as possible. Those who have the money and power are absolutely willing to shut everyone else out. And there's already been, you know, quite an effort on the part of the global bourgeoisie recently to tighten the walled world, and if you know what I mean, and cut down on people's ability to immigrate to places like perhaps North America and Europe compared to some other, you know, places, the ability for people to get in and flee, and that for a solution that really works for everybody worldwide and doesn't end in disaster and is probably successful anyway, it's going to require cooperation on a global scale. And the real elephant in the room here, an elephant in the sense is that it's like charging through the China shop, breaking every plate, is U.S. imperialism. It's really, not only is the U.S. military one of the world's foremost, you know, polluters, but the imperial project has contributed so enormously to these problems worldwide. And other countries having to compete in their inability to actually work towards climate change. As a quick example, China, as you mentioned, they've done more than just about any country on the earth recently to actually plan towards and actively combat climate change. And they have cut down their emissions. But there are still, you know, pollution problems in China. But because they have to compete, and they got the U.S. breathing down their doorstep, and it's hard to modernize your country because, you know, China was very underdeveloped, and they're still rapidly developing, on this global scene where you're kind of under the boot of the United States constantly, in a way that's ideal. And I think that China, especially under the recent governance of, the Xi Jinping, which is sort of gone in maybe a more socialist direction, I feel like, since his predecessor, since the reforms of Deng, has been wanting to inch towards that direction and take a more socialist aspect to things, but it's really hard on the global scale to go in the direction you want and still survive and compete. And the major impediment to all of these issues today, I feel like, is U.S. imperialism.
I can see that, and I can see that. Of course, when you're undertaking these changes, that's a lot of economic power that you have to divert to do these changes. And that's economic power that's not going towards something like competing with your neighbors and competing with other players on the world stage. Because unfortunately, even though we wish we could live in a utopian world where you don't have to compete with others and you can just exist as a nation out there and, you know, have a very friendly relationship with everyone, at the end of the day, it is a very much an imperialistic situation out in the world view that other countries seek to dominate the other countries. And I can definitely see where it would be difficult for a country like China to, you know, devote as many resources as it might be necessary to get this done quickly. At the same time, I also feel like it's a trap that we can fall in of where we can say, well, shouldn't other people be doing this? Why should I do something when other people aren't doing it? And it's like, well, the actions of one individual, of course, don't really make a huge difference on the whole, but we're not dealing with the actions of individuals here. Even though you are making a decision, you are still part of a society that is making a collective decision. Everyone is making that decision. And if people collectively decide, well, we aren't going to do anything, then yeah, it's going to be a situation where, sure, you as an individual haven't made a change, but because you as an individual and everyone else as an individual has decided not to make a change, well, now nothing is ever going to happen. And so we can't be lulled into this mindset of, especially what right-wing pundits will say of, well, why aren't these other groups doing their fair share? It's like, well, you got to start with yourself. You have to make a change in yourself before you can start criticizing others for not making that change as well. And certainly if the way things are going in America, we seem to be going in the exact opposite direction that we want to start even as we are moving away from our dependence on coal power plants, now the EPA is revising its rules, and we're having a strong push back towards getting things like coal-fired plants and fracking and things of this nature, very hazardous, polluting procedures. That it's
going back to your earlier point about sort of individual players or trying to, you know, tell another country or another individual to cut down. It would be an absurdity, of course, for everyone to start demanding that developing countries or India, you know, halt their usage of fossil fuels or polluting and, you know, switch over to renewable energy while the United States and Europe and those players remain the biggest polluters of all. You can't just selectively, you know, even though I wouldn't put it past the you know, current ruling class to try to say something like that. It's it's an unequal equation there. It is sort of going back to what I was saying earlier. It will require cooperation on a global scale.
Absolutely. And I think it's worth noting as well that there's a lot of things we as individuals can do to kind of save this. But at the same time, these articles on places like these mainstream news sites like Business Insider and, you know, MSNBC and CNN, these places that are responding to the thing like the UN report and stuff like that, are saying, how do we save the environment? Well, you know, let's cut back on our meat usage. Meat is a really big environmental thing. And, you know, it's if we all just stopped eating meat quite as much, it would be a big difference. And it's like, if you look at the numbers, yeah, there's stuff we can do at an individual level, and we should definitely be prepared to change our lifestyles to help not have a hell world. At the same time, the biggest polluters are not from individual actions. The biggest polluters are from corporations. Corporations produce the lion's share worth of pollution. It's the corporations that are very much responsible for a lot of this pollution. And a lot of the onus is on them that these folks with this collection of capital, a lot of the onus is on them to make a change.
Yes. And they won't. To be clear. And I think you hit the nail on the head there too, like with personal consumption, is that, you know, it's good. And I applaud you if you feel conviction that you can live in a way that uses less, and we'll all have to at some point in the future. But, you know, your individual consumption habits are really making a microscopic dent, if making even that, in the grand scheme of things. And that's why we've got to be critical of things like straw bans that, you know, have actually been pointed out to, you know, perhaps negatively affect people who are less abled. Is that, you know, compared to the international capitalism, the amount of difference or harm that you're causing is absolutely negligible. And if you just look at individuals and just single out these giant monolith corporations and militaries and just individual usage, you still find this massively upside down pyramid. Where I think I heard a statistic maybe earlier today or recently that something like 70% of goods consumed like 70% of all wealth expended and goods consumed and, you know, just consumption of general and energy and everything else, 70% of that is from the top 20% of wealth. So, you know, we're not talking about like the top 1%, like, but it's still, it's much higher up. It's greatly unweighted that the top 20% is really going through 70% of it. So it speaks to the need to completely dismantle the system that is.
Absolutely. And I think one of the most popular things that you can look at is stuff like cruise ships. As you know, cruise ships are just basically floating pollution piles that, like, cruise ships expel so much pollution both into the ocean in the form of wastewater, as well as just atmospheric emissions and things of that nature, as well as the entire infrastructure required to support a cruise ship. So much goes into this. And what is a cruise ship but a floating luxury resort? It's like, I understand why people would want this. And this is the thing, that it's not that we're the no fun squad and we're not here We're not here to tell you that, no, you can't have any fun because that pollutes the environment and we have to all live gray Meldrew lives because otherwise, lest we emit a single particle of CO2 into the atmosphere, we can't have any fun. It's not that. It's that we have to be responsible with these things. And it's like, if you want to go take a vacation somewhere, if you want to go to the Caribbean and enjoy the scenic sights and, you know, be a tourist and whatever, it's not that that's inherently wrong and we never want anyone to do that. Tourism still exists in socialist countries. That's still a thing, as much as the right-wing media might tell you otherwise. But at the same time, it's the sort of thing that you have to be wise about this. Is it better to take a cruise ship and float around the Caribbean, expelling all this waste and pollution and furthering the descent into this very apocalyptic Anthropocene that we're starting into? Or would it be better to just take a plane, which planes are very, despite being expelling a lot of pollution because they burn so much fuel, planes by person, by capita, are actually a very environmentally friendly thing, that planes are very efficient for getting people from one place to another really quickly, and it's actually not bad to fly a plane in the grand scheme of things. Would it be better to, rather than going on a cruise ship around the Caribbean, of taking a plane ride to Havana and enjoying the sights there and having a good time there versus having an entire infrastructure, having an entire platform, an entire city, as it were, floating on the ocean, expending all this waste and pollution when you could already make use of existing infrastructure, of existing facilities in a much more environmentally conscious way?
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I would just maybe to cap it off, reiterate, it's going to take a fundamental upside down, complete overhaul and change of how things are run and by whom it's run, by whom the world is run, and specifically by which class, because the current capitalist ruling class, which I think is actually, you know, scientifically presented this point by the UN paper that we were talking about, the capitalist ruling class has doomed us to extinction on the current course. It's gotten so grotesque and it's grown to such, the internal contradictions are so great that they're just killing the planet and mining it for profits. And the entire thing is going to have to be completely undone. And the working class is going to have to be the new master of society.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's that we don't have a do-over right now, folks. This is the sort of thing that there's not really many other options for us. We are not at the technological state where we can successfully colonize other worlds. If we tried to colonize the moon or Mars or the asteroid belt or somewhere tomorrow, we would fail. That there is no way to set up a self-sustaining colony on another world right now and have that actually work. And it's really a situation we have to protect ourselves here back at home. We have to make sure that this world does not become something inhospitable to human life, that we do not have a do-over right now. In the future, perhaps, when we have the technology, when we've established other colonies and other places, and, you know, we have a chance then, but right now, no, we don't have the economy, we don't have the technology, we don't have the willpower to do anything of that sort. And if we don't protect ourselves now, within our lifetimes, within the folks listening to this, I suspect, I don't know my exact age demographic, but I suspect most people here are early to middle age in their lives, and within our lifetimes, this will be a severe issue. The UN was predicting by 2050, we'll see severe things, and even now, we're seeing the disastrous consequences of how hurricanes continue to grow stronger and stronger. These weather patterns continue to grow stronger and stronger. And if you think this is bad now, just wait until Category 5 hurricanes are a yearly occurrence. I mean, Florence and Hurricane Michael were both extremely strong hurricanes. Just wait until this happens every year. What's going to happen when every year the coasts are battered by just truly horrific, awe-inspiring storms that you can't protect yourself against? That the nature becomes too powerful and the Earth will find an equilibrium. There will be a new equilibrium that the Earth will find. All systems go towards an equilibrium. But if
without us.
Yeah. If that equilibrium does not support us, if that equilibrium is not conducive to human life, then we're going to be in for a very bad time.
Uplifting note to end on there.
So just keep that in mind when you're voting for folks. I mean, this is the sort of
get involved. You know, yeah. The fight back's going to require everybody join a socialist organization, join a local organization, join the SRA if you're interested in the firearms and the defense of the working class. Join a party. Get involved somehow. Check out Food Not Bombs or something. You know, find some way to get involved and start to fight back.
Absolutely. And make sure this is an issue. Make sure this is talked about. This is one of the things that if you want anything to succeed, you have to make sure people talk about it. You have to make sure it's a conversation point. Not enough people talk about what's happening to the planet. And we have to make that a public thing, that we have to make sure people know about what's going on so that people can think about it and people can realize what the results of a disastrous decision could be. And then hopefully that builds the groundwork for a change where we do have a system in place where genuine and proper change can happen. And maybe we can avert some of the worst consequences that could happen if we just allow this system to continue on as it is. So as always, I can be contacted at HumphaDev and other resources provided in the show notes, and Brad here can be contacted at Georgia Marxist on Twitter should you wish to voice your thoughts, pleasant or not, at him. I'm sure he receives both all the time.
Yes, and I'm also the same name on the Slack if you're an SRA member.
So until next time, listeners, if the hell world doesn't, you know, happen next week, hopefully not that fast, but you know, things change every day, so who knows what might happen in the future. Until then.
I will point out, Alex, that much of my criticism is oriented around my dislike of cats.
This is true. Brad hates cats, and it's something that I can both respect him and not respect him for. I
had a traumatic childhood experience. The only cat I ever owned when I was a small child, it was very, very cruel and mean. And like it would, like, I would wake up with like it scratching my face and drawing blood, and it was very vicious. And I've just never liked them since.
Secretly, listeners, this is why Brad's now a socialist, is because of his bourgeoisie cat flashing out at him.
I don't know if you want to include all that or not, but anyways, I'll let you finish.
Anyways, remember, listeners, seize the means of production.
Later, y'all.